Shall we go for it, Overseas Judge? We suggested that he speak for about 45 minutes or so and give us an overview. I take it there's no slide presentation. Okay. So the judge will take us through the report as he sees fit. What we recommended in our letter to him is that it would be useful to focus more on the recommendations. And as we see it, the new committee will also have to be brief because they will have to process legislation, presumably, that will come from Treasury and the committee. And well, thank you very much, Judge. Over to you. And welcome once again.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good morning. I placed a document before you which contained the recommendations that we've made, and I'll come to that in due course. The report in this matter was quite a substantial document, and I'm not sure that you've had it before you, that you've looked at it, but it is on the presidential website if one needs to get it. Let me just introduce the people who were involved in this commission at the outset. You know, the commission was in fact a one-person commission, but the president then appointed Mr. Kashler, Advocate Masilo, and Professor Katz to assist the commission. All three of them were very useful to the commission. Mr. Kashler has a long history in business, which assisted us to understand the organizational structure and how things ought to work in a large organization like SARS. Advocate Silos at the Pretoria Bar, but she had worked for SARS for some time before, and so she was able to assist us a lot to understand the intricacies of the organization. And Professor Katz, of course, is steeped in tax administration. Unfortunately, for domestic reasons, he's not here today, but obviously his assistance was greatly appreciated. The Commission also appointed as counsel to assist it Advocate Steinberg, and Advocate Seo, and Advocate Hogden. Now let me just say at the outset that if this Commission achieved anything of significance and worth, the credit for it must go to Advocate Steinberg, who was extraordinary in the way she assisted the Commission. She worked relentlessly for long hours and weekends. Often she was subjected to abuse, but it didn't matter to her. She got on with the job, and I would attribute credit to anything that emerged of value from this commission to Advocate Steinberg. And also, the thing that struck us most about when we were involved in this commission is what extraordinary people they are at SARS. We found time and time again employees of SARS at a fairly senior level who are absolutely committed public servants, and it was gratifying to see that. And I can say quite confidently that certainly at the middle and lower level in SARS there are fine people there that will continue to do the work of SARS. The Acting Commissioner, Mr. Kingen, was also of great assistance to us, and in particular, he behaved as one would expect a senior public servant to behave when there is a commission of inquiry into the organization, which is that he opened the doors to us. He said, you can look at whatever you want. You can ask us whatever we want. He produced, gave us access to all the documents we wanted. He gave us access to all the people we wanted. And that is the proper behavior of a public servant who is now confronted with a commission of inquiry. We have to be open, frank, and allow the commission to make up its own mind as to what is happening rather than try to conceal. We thank Mr. Kingen very much for his assistance. I intend to focus particularly on the recommendations that were made by the commission, and in particular some of them that affect legislation which will be required if those recommendations are to be implemented. And I think that area in particular is a matter of particular interest and concern to you for me to give you some background to why the legislation will be enacted. But first, if I may, before we turn to that, let me just give you a little bit of background to SARS, which has determined the form of the recommendations that we've made. You'll know that SARS came into existence in 1997, I think it was, when Inland Revenue, Customs, and the various so-called Homeland Revenue authorities were brought together. Professor Katz was very instrumental in that. He was asked by former President Mandela to advise him on how to construct a tax collecting authority, and he and his committee did that over a number of years in a series of interim reports. There is one central plank to his idea of SARS and how it should operate, and that is that it should be have autonomy. It should be independent of the civil service, and it should be independent of politics, and it should be it should have a great deal of autonomy so that there is no interference. Now, that's the position in tax authorities all over the world, and rightly so. People who pay their taxes come from the whole spectrum of society, from all political persuasions, etc., and they should all have confidence that when they're paying that, their money into that bank account or so, that it is being honestly dealt with, that it is not the way it's being dealt with is not influenced by party politics in any way, and it should be free from the civil service as well, so that the running of SARS can be undertaken independently of the larger civil service. Now, that gives rise, though, to a difficulty, and that was the difficulty that I think occurred in SARS. If you have an autonomous body, you also have the great potential for an autocratic body. In other words, if you look at the SARS legislation, there is very little control to be exercised over the commissioner. The commissioner is in charge of SARS. He's answerable to no one. No one in the civil service. He reports to Parliament. But that's about it, and there are very few restrictions and guidelines in the legislation as to what he may and may not do. He or she, it happens to be a he all the way through. And that, of course, can be a very dangerous situation. It was created, though, in the days of shortly soon after 1994. I think that there was a mood then which didn't expect that you would have to have robust legislation to counter unethical behavior. Everyone was positive and optimistic. And so the legislation was quite weak as to the control to be exercised over the commissioner. There are two consequences of that. One is a consequence for, they're both aspects of governance, but there's a particular one in relation to SARS. First of all, we're talking about governance of the organization, as with any organization. Now, probably the strongest form of governance one has in an organization is other senior employees who are able to exercise some restraint upon the boss, as it were, on what he or she does. There are other aspects of governance as well that keep the organization honest, as it were. And then there is another aspect of governance in SARS, which is governance of the revenue collection. You will appreciate that something like 1.3 trillion rand comes into SARS every year. You can appreciate that it is a great prize for corruption. There are settlements that are done. Vehicles coming across the borders that have to be checked for what they're carrying and so forth. There's great potential for corruption. And so you need very strong governance mechanisms to avoid any untoward behavior in SARS. So there are two aspects of governance. The one is the organization, the other is revenue oversight. Now, this commission was established to investigate a four-year period from the 1st of April 2014 to the 31st of March 2018. Now, at that point, when SARS had first been established, Mr. Gordhan was the commissioner for some time before he became minister. He was succeeded by Mr. Magashula, who was there for a few years and then resigned, and he was succeeded by Mr. Pillay, the acting commissioner, for some time, until on the 27th of September 2014, Mr. Moyani was appointed commissioner. Over that four-year period, as you'll see in our report, at the beginning of the report, we said there is one central issue that arises in the course of our investigation, and that is a massive failure of governance. And I think that that is the central thing in this report, a massive failure of integrity and governance at SARS. Now, I've indicated to you the importance of governance in an organization like SARS, which is capable of becoming autocratic very easily. And in the report, we deal with various forms in which that occurred. And it occurred soon after Mr. Moyani arrived as commissioner. Now, he arrived in very unsavory circumstances in the first place, which we deal with in this report, and deal with the relationship he had with Bain and Company, who came in as consultants soon after he arrived. But let me leave that aside for the moment. What occurred within months of him arriving was that the EXCO was disbanded. Now, EXCO is an informal body. It's not provided for in legislation, but it is the management structure, the top management structure in SARS. It had always acted as a, established as an EXCO to advise the commissioner, and they sit, as Mr. Kenyon, I'm sure, has told you, they sit regularly. That is the management body. Well, it was disbanded within weeks of Mr. Moyani arriving. That was the end of that of oversight there. Within a month or two, the information technology regime was halted. Now, that is an ongoing regime. It has cost billions of taxpayers' money to establish over the years. You all know about e-filing and so forth. Some 10 years were spent in developing all that, and it is a continuing process. They called it there part of what they called the modernization program. Well, within months, Mr. Moyani walked in and stopped that. It has never been resumed. Now, the information technology systems are themselves a form of oversight, because they've got built-in checks, etc., which human intervention can't overcome. So there again, oversight of, in some respects, and particularly of the revenue governance I spoke of, that takes a back seat. He brought in Bain and Company, an American consulting firm. As I've said, there were very unsavory circumstances of his relationship with them, but they then came in and they undertook a major reorganization. That reorganization occurred over approximately 2 years, and it threw SARS into uncertainty and turmoil. No one knew what was happening. No one knew what was going to happen to their jobs. And as it turned out, many people found themselves marginalized and in supernumerary positions. What I mean by that, a supernumerary position, is a position that is outside the formal structure of SARS. They were sent off to an office. They sat in an office with no job description, no particular work to do. And there they sat until some people said, "This, I can't carry on like this," and resigned. And many middle management employees found themselves in that position, and a lot of them left. A lot of them were highly skilled, long experience in SARS, and all of that talent was left. There are still a lot of them left there, sitting in supernumerary positions. You ask somebody, "Well, what do you do?" He says, "I'm not quite sure." He sits in an office alone, no managerial functions, and yet those people were before undertaking managerial functions. Now, again, understand that people in the senior position, in managerial functions, have some oversight of what is happening in the senior management. So that level of oversight was gone. Later on, there was a gradual dismantling of other aspects of oversight as well. But within the first year or two, SARS was in turmoil. And It was a very distressing thing for us to see that. And I think Advocate Steinberg, perhaps that's, it spurred her on to see so many good public servants being dealt with in that way. There was great trauma there. And I want to, let me just read, I'll find it, a description given in evidence before us by a senior person there, where he said to us, it was, SARS was suffering post-traumatic stress syndrome. It had been so disrupted. So many people's lives had been disrupted. So many people had been hurt. And one of the important things, I think, about this commission is it gave some opportunity to these people to say what they had not been able to say for years. Because if you said anything in SARS, critical of the management, that was the end of you. There were disciplinary hearings that were being used to target people, and what had been apparently beforehand a culture in which there was rigorous debate, people said what they wanted to, that was, which is what one expects in a healthy organization, there was silence. The witnesses told us time and time again that there was fear throughout the organization. No one dared speak up. So the commission, I think, when we started, we found a lot of that. People wouldn't come forward. They were still fearful. They were a bit suspicious still of the commission. They didn't know what it was there for. They wouldn't come forward. Some of them just refused point blank. Latterly, more and more came forward as they saw what the commission was doing, and they wished to themselves have that voice. And that was a very distressing part of the conduct of this commission, as far as I was concerned, and I think for the rest of us as well. Now, an event occurred before this committee in about March 2015. There's a certain Mr. Lackey, who was the spokesman at SARS. Mr. Lackey left in about February or March of 2015. He felt that he was being forced out, and indeed, the problem with Mr. Lackey was that he was concerned at the media statements that were being made, and he was concerned that nothing was being done to counter the so-called rogue unit story that had occurred at that time, and I'll come back to that. But he was sidelined, and his responsibilities were passed over to Mr. Luther Labella. Mr. Lackey resigned, and he wrote a very long letter to this committee in which he said what was happening in SARS. Now, all that Mr. Lackey got out of that was that he got sued by Mr. Moyani. He got an action brought against him for, it was said, breaching his oath of secrecy and defamation and so forth. Now, as a long-standing lawyer, my view is, I mean, it was a ridiculous claim. For two reasons. What was sought was a declaration that he had breached his oath of silence. Well, so what? If he had, you'd get a declaration from a court. What does that help? It's nothing. Defamation action. SARS is not capable of being defamed. That's the law. As far as defamation of Mr. Moyani is concerned, a public servant has no right to ride on the back of a state institution to sue in his personal capacity. But what does litigation do to a person like Mr. Lackey? Probably hasn't got a lot of money. It intimidates him. He faces the prospect, if he goes into that litigation, of incurring huge costs. That's what happened to Mr. Lackey. He got nothing from this committee. Now, the chairman has sent a letter to us explaining what happened, you know, why he got no assistance from this committee. I don't want to debate that. I'm sure that the committee, as the chairman has pointed out, had good reason to. Essentially, I think the chairman, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, said, look, we don't have the power to intervene and do anything. Now, I raise this because it's very important. There was SARS going through this thing. You couldn't find anyone to intervene. You couldn't even go to a parliamentary committee and get intervention. This is very important for a recommendation I'm going to come to. What does one do if things are happening in SARS as they were happening? If you cannot go to Parliament, where do you go? There is no other oversight mechanism. The only one would be with the President who appointed you, and he could remove you. But if the former President Zuma appointed Mr. Moyani, and there's no prospect he's going to remove him, certainly not within 6 months of his arrival. There was no one to go to. I'll come back to that. As things progressed, you'll find, as we found, numerous opinions that were being sought all the time by the commissioner as to what his powers were, and essentially, what could he do without any interference? For example, at one stage, Minister Gordhan, who was the Minister of Finance at the time, said to him, look, I believe you're going to want to pay bonuses to the staff. We're in a time of austerity. Number one, you need my approval to pay bonuses, which is correct under the statute. You better ask for my approval, and secondly, take account of the austerity with which we face at the moment. Well, opinions were sought. Do I have to ask Minister Gordhan for his permission and so forth? Because Mr. Moyani didn't want to have to do that. Ultimately, he litigated against the Auditor General because the Auditor General had qualified his accounts because he didn't have authority to make bonuses. I have never heard of litigation by one department against the Auditor General. It's unheard of, and rightly so. The Auditor General is an independent person who oversees the accounts. He forms opinions, and as far as I'm concerned, no judge can interfere with the opinions formed by the Auditor General in good faith, and he had formed these opinions in good faith. He had himself taken legal advice, which said his qualification of the reports was approved. Then there was the Davis Advisory Committee. You know what that committee is, I'm sure, with Judge Dennis Davis in charge, who oversees, who provides advice from time to time on tax policy and so forth. Well, Judge Dennis Davis was insulted and cast off. No one spoke to him. He couldn't even get information out of SARS. Then there was the Financial Intelligence Center. It sent reports of unusual deposits to the accounts, to the bank account of Mr. Mokgwa, who was then in charge of all taxpayer affairs. Well, the Financial Intelligence Center got insulted. I understand even that they've been reported to the public protector. Where did they get the information from? Well, the Financial Intelligence Center reports unusual payments into the account of a senior SARS official. The thing you do is investigate it. You don't go and investigate the Financial Intelligence Center. Within SARS itself, as far as the organization was concerned, there's a lot of control over governance in the sense of taxpayer affairs, because there were units there that oversaw, within the unit, people oversaw each other. Take, for example, the large business center, which gathered together accountants, lawyers, whatever, into a group who dealt with particular taxpayers, the end-to-end service. But there's governance in that as well, because everyone knows what's happening as far as that taxpayer is concerned. But that was broken up. People sent off to different divisions. The result of that is you've got the left hand doesn't necessarily know what the right hand is doing. So you don't have oversight of large taxpayers. The anti-corruption units were pulled apart, have never really been established or re-established. For 4 years, you had no inquiry into the illicit trades, in particular the cigarette trade. Now, the taxes on cigarettes relatively don't bring in a huge amount of the total revenue. Mr. Kingan will give you the figure, but as I understand, I think it's about 12 billion rand or so. But once you don't have oversight in that area,
Once you're not inspecting the factories that are making cigarettes and seeing whether they're paying excise, once you're not opening the containers that come across the border to see if customs duties are being paid on cigarettes, there's a huge lot of money to be made. There was no control of those units. One of the units that did that kind of work was disbanded soon after Mr. Mulyani arrived and was never revived. What was revived, what was created, was a small unit with no control over it, no governance over it, reporting direct to Mr. Mulyani, whose only job, as we saw, was called the Tobacco Task Team. The one thing it didn't do is investigate the tobacco trade. What it investigated is the investigators who are investigating the tobacco trade. And as a consequence, disciplinary proceedings were at times put together. So at every level, and that's what is said in this report, Mr. Mulyani arrived there and dismantled governance one by one until there was very little control at the end of it. Now, that's a bit of the background that we found as we listened to all the evidence in this matter. Let me just turn to the work of the Commission and the progress of the Commission. It was set up with the instruction to report in 6 months. The terms of reference were very wide and in many respects very vague. I think the terms of reference, as they were framed, illustrates that no one was quite sure what was happening within SARS. People knew that things were happening, but not quite sure what they were. And so the terms of reference were drafted in fairly wide terms. Now, in my experience, what happens when you establish commissions of inquiry is almost the first thing they do is they ask for an extension of time. We were given 6 months. It became apparent to us very soon, as we went in there, that things had to be done urgently. There was no way we are going to ask for an extension of time. We were going to finish because it had to be done. And it had to be done because revenue was being lost. You've heard a figure, and the analysts told us that there was a shortfall in the estimate of recovery for the last year of 50 billion rand. Now, part of that may well be the economy, but everyone agreed that at least a significant part of it was because of inefficiency at SARS. The country can't afford to be losing 50 billion rand that should be collected. I understand there will be expected to be a shortfall this year, but Mr. Kenyon will know more about that, which is not surprising, bearing in mind the uncertainty that there has been in SARS for the year. So it became very apparent to us that urgent steps were required to start correcting it. Now, a lot of the terms of reference dealt with events that had occurred. As far as we are concerned, the primary inquiry had to be how to correct things to go into the future, because taxes need to be collected, as you all know. There are projects that have to be put in place, and you don't do it without money. So instead of asking for an extension, say, for a year, in other words, doubling the time that was allowed to us, Advocate Steinberg doubled the time she worked from 8 hours to 16 hours a day. And that's how we got through this. It was an enormous task to get through, and it was done admirably. People will say there are some shortcomings in the report. They say it's not powerful enough, not strong enough, we didn't deal decisively enough with some of the evidence. Well, that may be so. But the primary objective was to get SARS back on track again. It could not carry on like that. We delivered an interim report for that reason, because what was abundantly clear to us within a few months was that Mr. Mulyani had to go. It could not carry on with Mr. Mulyani in charge. He had to go. And that's why in an interim report we recommended to the President that he be removed urgently so that he could be replaced by a commissioner whose interest was in the public service and not other interests, whatever they might have been, but someone who will get SARS up and running again, and that is the recommendation that was made. It was made early on because it was clear to us that nothing could be achieved at SARS without that. We said in that interim report that does not mean that everything will fall into place as soon as Mr. Mayani is removed as the commissioner, but without his removal, nothing can occur, and we might as well close up shop right now. Well, as it happens, the president accepted that recommendation, and he removed Mr. Mayani from office. There has been a lot of litigation around that. I think that the last round, as far as we can see it, finished a few days ago when the Constitutional Court turned down an application by Mr. Mayani for leave to appeal against the judgment of the High Court, which was scathing of the way he had conducted the litigation. So that's a bit of the background, and if there are questions in due course, please feel free to ask me them. But let me now go to the recommendations that were made, and you might then look at the document that I distributed before you. You'll see that numbered from page north for some reason, but turn to page one. You'll see that at the end of September we recommended that the President take steps without delay to remove the current commissioner and take steps without delay to appoint a new commissioner. We also recommended, though, that there should be some sort of process by which the commissioner was appointed. There was nothing in the legislation. It just says the president must appoint a commissioner. No process at all. And that's what happened as far as the appointment of Mr. Mayani was concerned. I think it came as a bit of a shock to the people that he suddenly announced that he had been appointed. We recommended to the president that there should be a process. It should be a transparent process, and we understand that that is occurring at the moment. I think the newspaper, I don't have to say more than that, the newspaper Business Day reported, I think today or yesterday, that interviews have been held with a number of people. A panel was set up under the chair of I know when you get old names don't come to you again quickly. Of Mr. Manuel. It's a very senior panel. They will decide in due course. They have a short list and they will make recommendations to the minister. That panel has conducted interviews in private, and you might ask, how is that consistent with transparency? Our view was, this is such an important position. You want to make sure you get the right person, and you don't want that person, any person, to hold back because of television cameras and so forth. Conducted in private, but the transparency will come in this form, that the panel's recommendations must be motivated and they must be made public in due course. In other words, if the president ignores them, at least the public will know who these people were, what the recommendations were, and that he's gone against those recommendations. But one will know the views of the panel, whoever the president ends up appointing, and of course it's the president's prerogative to appoint who he wishes. Let me come then to recommendations addressed to the legislature, because that was the recommendation to the president. That was within his power to act upon, no one else's, and that was the recommendation to him. For the rest, the recommendations don't actually involve the president. He's got no other powers. And they are really directed at two places thereafter. One is the legislature, legislative changes that are needed. And the second is to the commissioner, at present the acting commissioner, and in due course a permanent commissioner, whether it is the present acting commissioner or anyone else. Dealing first with the recommendations addressed to the legislature, we have recommended a proper process for the appointment and removal of the commissioner of SARS. There is nothing in the legislation at the moment about it, and that's what we recommend that you would bring into legislation. The process that we recommended is that the president may decide himself who to put forward, or he may call for nominations, and he must then from that select a suitable candidate. but very important as to the qualities we say we recommend be proposed for the appointment of a commission. And I think it is very important. We've said he must be and be reputed to be of unblemished integrity. He must have proven experience of managing a large organization at a high level. And importantly, he must not be aligned to any constituency, and if so, aligned should renounce it. In other words, this should not be a political appointment. You politicians can choose your battlegrounds in other areas, but leave SARS out of it. SARS must not be a political battleground. And I've said why that should not be so, and that is depending on taxpayers across the spectrum. They must all have confidence in SARS. And the only way they will have confidence in SARS is if they know that the commissioner is answerable to no one else. We've recommended there that the candidate or candidates should be subject to private interview by a panel. Again, the members of the panel should not be politically appointed. One doesn't want lobbying for a particular person. One doesn't want people seeking the approval of particular constituencies. The panel itself must be an independent panel. So you'll see from both of those, we say, keep politics out of SARS. One has seen enough of politics in SARS. And then thirdly, the panel must motivate its recommendations to the President and must make public those recommendations and its motivation. The President, of course, must have the power then to appoint whoever he chooses, but if he chooses to reject the views of the panel, well, he will have to answer for that politically and in full to the public. There is also one change there as far as the appointment is concerned. At the moment, it is in the sole prerogative of the President. We have recommended that the President should act in consultation with the Minister of Finance. Now, for the last 4 years, there's been very little interaction with the Minister of Finance. Yet the person who collects the money and the person who spends the money should be talking to one another. There has been nothing like that. There's been a standoff between the Commissioner and the Minister of Finance for some time, very unfortunately, but the two should be acting together, and that's why we recommend that the Minister should also have some say in who the Commissioner should be. We've also recommended the appointment of a Deputy Commissioner. Some might say, well, more than one, it doesn't matter. But what we've put that in for is, again, for this question of governance. There should be legislatively someone who is appointed there who the commissioner can't simply get rid of. One or more deputies will serve a very important governance function in that they can place constraints upon the actions of the commissioner and, if necessary, take up problems that he finds within the SARS elsewhere. That person, we say, should not have any line for management functions, but one would expect that the powers of the commissioner would be delegated to the deputy or deputies. The next one, which is towards the bottom, page 4, we say that the commissioner should be obliged to have an executive committee. At the moment, he's not obliged. The executive committee is there at his whim, and as I've told you, one of the first things Moyani did was to disband the executive committee. He established it again later, but a lot of new faces in it, and the old faces have gone. So he must be obliged to appoint an executive committee. Who should be that executive committee must obviously be left to him. It will be his senior management. One can't dictate to him who should be on the exco, except for one, that the deputy or the deputies must be on the exco. He cannot get rid of them. If he comes into conflict with his exco and fires the whole lot, at least he's got to keep the deputy or deputies who must always be on exco. In other words, there has got to be someone close to the commissioner who is watching what is happening and is able to influence what is happening. Now let me come to what we consider the second most important recommendation. There were two recommendations made which are pivotal. The one is you've got to change the commission. The second one is we have recommended that a body, an independent body, be established that can exercise oversight. Let me come back to what happened in March of 17 when Mr. Lacquer came to this committee. Parliamentarians said, we can't help you. There was no help. And we said there has to be an organization of some kind to which people can go for help if this recurs. We have suggested that an Inspector General be appointed. They have that in Australia. They have that in the United States. It's a person independent of SARS, but with powers to intervene in SARS, not to interfere with what the Commission is doing, but to make inquiry, to have investigative powers, to find out what is going on if things are going wrong, and to deal with it as best that the Inspector General is able to, whether it is by going to the President, going to Parliament, telling the public, whatever the case may be. There are two aspects of that I want to highlight, because it is we think it is a very important change that we're making. One must be very careful, though, of setting up another empire of some kind. That is not what is intended. This is not to be a large body that now has staff all over the place and so forth, and an empire gets built. This must be a lean body. You want an Inspector General with perhaps a couple of assistants, and that's it. That's all that is required. Or what was required for this Commission of Inquiry. Not a huge body of people. It required a couple of my colleagues here, Advocate Steinberg, and they did a lot of investigation. What more do you require? It should not become itself a major bureaucratic organization. That will simply slow it down. It will not be effective. This has to be a lean and a slim organization that is able to intervene, to make inquiries and so forth. If there had been such a person, Mr. Lacquer could have gone to that person. There's a second aspect of that, and that is, when we were looking at some sort of body of that nature outside SARS, there were various recommendations. One was, well, should the powers of the tax ombud, who is at the present Judge Webby, should his powers be extended to cover this kind of thing? And we thought not. The tax ombud deals with taxpayer affairs, and we think it's very important to keep taxpayer affairs separate from organizational affairs within SARS. So we don't support that suggestion. There is also a suggestion that a board of some kind should be established. We also have rejected that. A board is it's an ad hoc type of body. It's not there on the spot all the time. They tend to be very slow to act, difficult to act, because one has to get a lot of cohesion. They don't meet all the time. And one must look again also at what happened when such a board was established. You will know that the Tax Advisory Board was established under the chairmanship of Judge Kruger. Well, all these things were taking place. They were all placed before Judge Kruger, and they all went through. Why? Because what happens with the board? No one's really investigating. Mr. Moyani comes and presents something to the board, and if he wants it to go through, it's a very nice presentation, which is what happened. Bain and Company came along. They did a one-hour presentation to the committee. It approved it. This was a major reorganization. We asked Judge Kruger if he would come and give evidence, which he did. And Advocate Steinberg asked him, what did you know about SARS before? What kind of organization was it that you were going to report? He knew nothing of it. That's the nature of a board. It's an ad hoc body. It does what is placed before it. That's not what we have in mind. We have in mind an investigating body with the powers that would ordinarily be had by a commission of inquiry. It just happens to be a commission, as it were, that is on the spot, that is ongoing, people can talk to it, you can investigate things that you consider are going wrong, etc. But it's an ongoing thing and not a not an ad hoc body that has reports. So I'd like we would like you to consider that recommendation in particular. We think it would go a long way towards avoiding what occurred at SARS. And had it been there, we think that a lot of what happened at SARS would not have happened. The next, at page 6, we've recommended that the SARS Commissioner should be required to submit a business plan annually to the Minister and get the approval of the Minister of that business plan. At the foot of page 6, there was controversy within SARS for some time, as I mentioned, about whether the Commissioner had carte blanche as far as the appointment of and payment of senior staff was concerned. The minister said no. The minister was in fact correct, but court walked, you know, went off to court cases on that, and we just suggest that that section in the Act be amended. No one has ever told me my voice is fading. But we just said that's a small matter. We just suggest that the section be just amended to make it quite clear that terms of employment should be. Require the approval of the minister. Let me give you an example of what occurred here. Two senior employees were appointed. On the top management structure, consent of the minister was not sought. In fact, he was just told that this had occurred. They were appointed at salaries of something like 2.1 million rand a year. A month later, they said, you know, our salaries are lower than the others enough. We want it increased. Well, overnight it was increased by about almost 1 million rand a year. For no particular reason other than that you want parity with the others. We ask ourselves, well, if you took a job at 2.1 million, well, accept that. But you can't a month later go and ask for it to be almost doubled, or a third, 40% increase. But if you had had required ministerial approval, I suspect that wouldn't have occurred. But within SARS it did occur. And one can see that there would be good reason why a commission of SARS would be willing to spend taxpayers' money to ensure that he had around him people that he approved of. There was also, on page 7, there was a weakness in the procurement process for both the major contracts that were procured there, one for Bain and Company to come in and reorganize, the other for another company to come in and review the information systems. I don't think I need to address that. It's a recommendation addressed to the Treasury that they should review the procurement process to avoid that kind of thing. Then there are a number of recommendations which will be of interest to you, but they don't require any action by the legislature. They really address the commissioner, the acting commissioner, and the new commissioner. Now, let me say immediately that a number of these have already, Mr. Kingan has already started implementing a number of these. So it's not as if he's sitting back and waiting for something to happen. A number of them are on the go, and we commend him for having taken the initiative to do that. However, there's a limit to what an acting commissioner can do. Appointed for a period of 90 days at a time. You can't engage in major projects if you're not quite sure who the commissioner is, who the senior management are going to be, and they can take responsibility for these major projects to carry them through. Now, one of the major projects here has got to be the getting the information technology back on stream again. Billions of rand have been spent already, and the systems are falling into arrears, they're falling into disrepair. We know that information technology advances very rapidly, and if SARS can't keep up with the business community of what's happening out there, if they can't keep up, they're going to lose revenue. There will probably be major investment required.
You can't do that if you're just the acting commissioner. You've got to have proper long-term management in place for those kind of decisions. So the acting commissioner is at the moment rather hobbled by what he can do. And if I may say so, my impression is that the acting commissioner is having a lot of difficulty as well with some of the people who should be advising him and assisting him to get on with his job. Let me just tell you what defines for you the crime of fraud. One always thinks, might think of fraud as necessarily involving money, and it doesn't. Fraud is making a misrepresentation to someone with intent to defraud them, a false misrepresentation with intent to defraud them, causing prejudice or potential prejudice. That's all it is for fraud. You don't have to have money involved. And not saying something can also constitute a misrepresentation. Now, if you saw how Bain and Company was appointed, you see the letters that were written to the minister for their appointment. Not only were they positively misleading for the minister to read them, but a lot was not said there that ought to have been said. In particular, Mr. Minister, when I'm asking you for permission to approach consultants, what I haven't told you is that I've been in cahoots with a consultant for almost a year, and that we have already arranged that consultant should get the job. Now, that is undoubtedly a misrepresentation. Does it cause prejudice? Of course it causes prejudice. What would the minister have done had he known that this was going on? Would he have simply approved it? I have little doubt that he wouldn't. Then you go to the bid adjudication committees, and you don't tell them that either, and you allow the bid, you manipulate the bids in order to appoint Bain and Company. In both cases, these are misrepresentations. In both cases, they cause prejudice, or at least potential prejudice. It's not for us to decide whether crimes have been committed, but we've said on the face of it, the National Director of Public Prosecutions should investigate and see whether the offence of fraud should be prosecuted as far as the award of those contracts are concerned. I went back a bit to what was addressed to the National Director of Public Prosecutions. We've recommended, as you'll see on page 8, that the large business centre be re-established. That would be the business has told us how compliance is falling behind simply because business can't deal with SARS anymore. They can't get efficient service. And they would welcome the re-establishment of the large business centre, which Mr. Kingen is at the moment attempting to do. There was a compliance unit which monitored tax compliance that was disbanded. There were the integrity unit that was disbanded, and we were recommended that they be re-established. On page 9, I've pointed out that the further development of information technology was summarily halted, not being resumed, and we've said that be addressed urgently. There was a contract awarded to another consultancy to look at information technology within SARS. On their own admission, they said it was all what the work they did was never implemented. It was all a waste of 200 million baht rand. The award of that contract is very suspect. We've recommended that be investigated to see if that contract is in fact lawful or not. We've also recommended that the commissioner recruit someone to take over information technology. There is a person at the moment who is in charge of information technology. We think that this information technology is far too complex to be left in that situation, and one must go and recruit someone. The person who developed it was a man called Mr. Barry Hall, who by all accounts is a genius in this field, although he has problems in other aspects of his personality in dealing with people, but there it is. There are very few people around that are able to take control of such of technology of this kind. You can't just take someone who knows how to do the internet and to do the payroll stuff and so forth. You need high-skilled people, and we've recommended that they should go around headhunting to find someone. page 9 towards the foot, I've told you about the number of employees in supernumerary posts and former employees, and we've recommended that the commissioner evaluate how to use these people properly instead of having them sit in offices doing nothing and of course earning good salaries and things. And we've suggested that he should also seek to recruit some of the employees who felt themselves driven out of SARS because they were put in these positions. We've also suggested that the new commissioner should review his top management. Not many of them are left. Some of them have resigned and so forth. One is under inquiry in a disciplinary proceeding. But one had a period here in which we saw no sign of other than of compliance to what was happening in SARS. No one stood up and said, what's happening? No one confronted the commissioner. Now you might say, well, you would have lost your job. As far as we're concerned, if you're a public servant and you see something wrong, then you should stand up and leave the community to lose your job. No one did that during this period, and we suggest the commissioner should review his senior staff and determine whether they are people who can inspire public confidence in the integrity of SARS, bearing in mind some of the matters that we dealt with in the report. There were two senior staff members, one is now left, who were appointed with their salaries and remuneration not approved by the minister, and we suggest that be looked at. Top of page 11, it is recommended that SARS re-establish capacity to monitor and investigate the illicit trades, in particular the trade in cigarettes, within appropriate governance structures. Now, apparently it costs about R2.50 to make a packet of cigarettes. The duties on it are approximately R17.50, and they get sold for, I suppose, R30 or R35. You can buy packets of cigarettes for R10. And you can buy packets of cigarettes for R10 because people are not paying customs duties when they import cigarettes, and they're not paying excise duty when they manufacture them. And no one's looking at that, and we've said we should re-establish that. Now, there's a potential problem with that kind of investigative body, which led to this trouble about the so-called rogue unit 4 years ago. The investigation of this kind of thing involves some covert activity, and one knows that people can overstep the line, etc. Well, there must be proper governance structures to avoid that occurring, but there is nothing unlawful about SARS undertaking covert activity. The commissioner obtained from very senior counsel during the course of 2015 an opinion to that effect. Counsel advised that there's nothing wrong with secretly following a truck when it's come across the border. Nothing wrong with sitting outside a cigarette factory and observing when the trucks go in and out. Nothing wrong with a whole lot of things which one might regard as covert, provided you don't go into people's private lives. So there's no reason why you shouldn't have such a unit. And it is essential that you have such a unit. You can't deal with criminality out in the open. You've got to have some covert activity. And I understand that some capacity in that respect is being re-established. There are problems with VAT refunds. That's, a systemic matter that is being dealt with. There was a lot of litigation engaged in by the commissioner, as well as other legal costs involved. They all concerned his own personal interests. Every time a journalist published anything critical, the journalist received a summons. So there were a number of summonses out there. They've all now been withdrawn. But we have our conclusion is that they were all, they weren't commenced in the interests of SARS. They were commenced in the interests of closing down any criticism of SARS. And we've suggested that that SARS should recover the legal costs and expenses that incurred from the commissioner. There are recommendations about settlement of disputes. Again, these are governance issues, but they come from within SARS.
There are problems with case selection and audit protocols, particularly for lifestyle audits, I might call them. In other words, one looked at some taxpayer affairs of people who seem to have lots of money and they seem to pay very little income tax. And no one's really looking at those because of, I think, largely systemic problems within SARS which must be corrected. There are debt collection contracts that have been entered into which we don't think are adding much value to SARS, and it is recommended that those be reconsidered. There were media statements issued which are scurrilous. They should not be issued by an organization like SARS, and we've recommended some investigation in that regard. And it's recommended again that SARS takes steps to restore proper relationships with other authorities, meaning National Treasury, the Prosecuting Authority, the Auditor General, the Financial Intelligence Center. One can't have SARS at war with those organizations. And that it should also take steps to restore relations with the OECD. SARS was highly regarded within the OECD. The OECD has no interest in SARS anymore, and relationships must be restored there. We should retain our high standing in the international community. So that is a synopsis of the recommendations we have made, and a little bit of the background to why we made them. I welcome your questions.
Thank you for that comprehensive report. Do your colleagues want to say anything? Please. Will you want to say something?
Nothing for me to add, sir.
Okay, thank you. Okay, over to members.
Thank you, Chair. First, let me start on a lighter note. I said, what a present do I have for my birthday to get the Nugent Commission report? No, you can't.
All right, I move.
You can't sing it. It will be a terrible voice.
I move and second the resolution, just noticeable, wishing her well for today.
Chair, Chair, we welcome the report by the Commission. First, I need to say, as the committee, we are a committee that strives to do our best to play an oversight role. And I picked in the Commissioner's presentation that similarly, you're not very happy with how we dealt with the Lacay issue. And I might be wrong, but let us put it up front to say it's a matter that we discussed thoroughly as the committee. The chair actually consulted me as the week to say how do we approach this issue. As people who need to follow the law to the latter, whether the law's got its limitations or not, we had to look at what are the prescripts of the law in terms of what we can do as the committee and what we cannot do. And I'm happy that part of the recommendations that has been made today is to ensure that there is a mechanism in place to play a rigorous oversight. That's the first thing. Secondly, I'm happy that you raised the issue of the tobacco industry. I personally bemoan every time we meet in these gatherings the removal of the Border Management Authority from this entity to Home Affairs. I protested because I had a feeling and a sense that it's going to weaken oversight in terms of excise and customs control, also in terms of revenue collection. And similarly, we were correct. And maybe part of the recommendations, Chair, that we will make is to insist that the Border Management Authority must come back because it was more effective when it was here. I'm also happy that you make a recommendation that staff that left must come back. But also, there's one issue that I believe we should take into account in terms of the South African demographics, and SARS is not immune to that. In South Africa, you have a situation where senior management positions are not reflective of the demographics of South Africa. And I was happy when the president said in the State of the Nation address that we should move away in South Africa from a perception that young people should not be given an opportunity to participate due to lack of experience. So I hope as we do these things, we're going to take into account the need to transform both to address demographics, especially gender and race. Because in South Africa, we have not yet arrived at a point where we are reflective of our democracy. So in those recommendations, I'll take it for granted that those things will be taken into account. The only issue that I believe should be highlighted above all other weaknesses that were in the system is the role of the commissioner in terms of weakening governance. It's very, very important for us to look not only on the executive structures that were removed and all other things. And one clarity will be on the role of the so-called, I don't want to call it a rogue unit, I want to call it a so-called rogue unit, because I'm one person who insisted that you are not going to put an institution of this nature and magnitude and not give it a capacity to do rigorous oversight. And I'm going to make an example. In my previous life, I used to work in the DTI, and one of the things I investigated was piracy. And we realized when we dealt with issues of piracy that it needed to involve serious investigations of the underworld, of DVDs and CDs that were actually produced in underground factories in South Africa and sold in the streets. And part of confiscation and investigation does not need men and women in ties who are going to meet up with people who are involved in criminal activities. So you needed to have a very sharp-minded team that needed to do that. So that's why at that stage we involved the Hawks and the police service. So that recommendation to me remains important, because it's one industry that participate in illicit outflows and inflows. And Floyd Shivambo, sitting here, is very keen about the illicit trade, and the former president, Mbeki, has actually given us figures on what we lose on illicit trade. So once you don't have capacity on that, then it comes a challenge. So we will take some of those recommendations into consideration as the committee, I hope, Chair, to make sure that there is some form of integrity in our institutions. My last point is I don't want to... Advocate Mwepe has been vindicated on the issue of information technology, because the Umbas person came to report to us that the systems, as they stand, were a challenge. So listening to you giving that feedback today regurgitates the point that was made at that time by the Umbas person on information technology, on tax refunds. Hence, we had a 50 billion hold to plug, which we have not plugged into its entirety, and the delay of refunds to people to boost up the books to look good, which is something that if we had a commissioner, we were going to hold to account, because at that time, Chair, he denied vehemently of such activities. I remember very well in that room we were on the other side, where we had to even decide that we were going to do an unconventional thing to investigate certain things, including Mr. Makwakwa's account, when the law was making it impossible to allow transparency, because the nature of the South African Tax Act itself, and I thought maybe there was going to be a recommendation about the Tax Act, because it also limits to do certain things as Parliament because of its stringent protection of individuals' books. Hence, when we came to the report of the FIC, we had to do the checks and balances, whether can we discuss issues that are leaked in the media or not, and were seen at that time by either the media or the public as avoiding to deal with corruption, whereas we were hamstrung by the law to do certain things. So we will look at those recommendations. We will zoom into specific recommendations, including the role of the FIC in making investigations and gathering information that will make sure that we run a clean state. So thank you very much for the presentation, Chair. Those are the things that I wanted to raise for today. Thank you.
Order in which they're going to speak, so just go as you go. I have to go.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you to Judge Nugent and the team. I had the pleasure of spending a day with you, and I can testify to the stringent nature and hard work that was put in. Thank you very much, certainly from me, for that. It's
observe the commission.
I did, yes.
Oh, right.
And no need for you to know. I do what I choose to do. I don't report to you, Tandy.
Do you on behalf of the committee or as a tax expert?
I do it on behalf of the people of South Africa.
Because I don't trust you that much, you know.
That's quite evident.
The reason I ask is because if you appeared before the commission, which is what I wanted to do, I'll come to that. It's odd because they report to Parliament and so on. But just that's all I'm checking.
He didn't appear before the commission. I saw him in the audience once.
No, I know. Yeah. Yes. But if you see what's happening...
That's terrified, Chair. No, that's okay. You are just in the audience. Just in the audience.
I have every right to appear if the commission wanted me to and to be there in the audience.
No.
As
fine.
It happens,
you're right.
I was in the audience.
No, she's just needling you. You know.
Of course she is. I know that. And my degree of trust in Tiny perhaps doesn't match her lack of trust in me. So thank you very much for the work that's been done. I think we were in this very room, that's irrelevant, I suppose, when Commissioner Moyane was sitting round about where you are and Mr. Makwakwa was next to him, when we first raised the issue of Mr. Makwakwa. And Moyane at that stage was fully aware of, as it's turned out, but he sat there and denied any knowledge of it. Was it V227? Yeah. And so, you know, the point that Tandy makes about our ability to get to the nitty-gritty is really, really concerning. And I understand the need for taxpayer confidentiality. I would hate to in any way interfere with that as a general principle. But if we take, for instance, the question of the commissioner's ability to determine what should or should not happen and so on. And I know that the current acting commissioner is time and time again said that there will be no favour shown to any particular taxpayer. And that's as far as he can go. He can't say to this committee, I have made sure that Jacob Zuma's fringe benefits tax on his Nkandla improvements has been paid. That's a public interest issue, but it can't be made public because the public want to know those kind of things, and it's an example time. There are others. And the Inspector General may well be able to do that, but will he? Sorry, I should really frame this as a question. The intention of your recommendations, is the Inspector General be able to do that kind of thing? In other words, it's an issue raised from outside of SARS, not to the tax ombud, who equally can't divulge it. The Inspector General can go in and do the investigation if your recommendation is such. But what is the ability, in your recommendation, for that Inspector General to set the minds of ordinary South Africans at rest about an issue like that, that happens to be in the public domain. I'm really, that it's of great concern. Makwakwa issue is another one. Perhaps I should have left Jacob Zuma out of it. Just look at the Makwakwa one. It's all very well to have an Inspector General perhaps do the right thing, perhaps not do the right thing, but what feedback is there to ordinary South Africans that the job has been done? In terms of Mr. Moyane, I see that your referral to the the Director of Prosecutions refers to some contracts which could or could not have constituted fraud. Is that the limit of where the malfeasance was, just those two contracts that you've come across? I mean, you didn't do a full forensic investigation, but within the confines of the work of the Commission, is that the limit, just those two contracts? As you say, I was quite thrilled to hear the Constitutional Court had finally ruled that Mr. Moyane must go, and it was a long battle, particularly on my front as an individual, but my party, that he should not have been appointed in the first place and that he should go. So thank you for the role you have played in that, and particularly with your interim report. The question of the President appointing the Commissioner, I know that this is a summary document, and I haven't looked in your full report, so please forgive me if it's there, but you mentioned in consultation with the Finance Minister. I can't find it in the summary, but perhaps it is there, but the important point is not whether it's there or not. I'm quite sure that's in your document somewhere. The question really is, what do you mean by in consultation? In other words, does it mean that if the Finance Minister does not approve of the candidate, that the President may not appoint that candidate? Is that the recommendation that you're making? This is not meant to sound like some kind of inquisition. Please forgive me if that's the way I'm coming across, because I'm really very, very grateful for the work that you've done. So please forgive me if I seem to be in any way inquisitorial about this. But you're recommending that we go and, well, the SARS goes and headhunts an IT specialist. Barry Hall presumably would be a great guy to come back, but he's now running a bank, I think, and so it's unlikely. By implication then, the person who currently holds that IT executive position is, in your opinion, not capable. Am I drawing a conclusion that is not correct? Mr. Chairman, thank you, and once again, thank you to the Commission.
Thank you, Chair. I think you must be very patient with me, because let's deal with conceptual issues, contextual issues first. So the Border Management Authority is a bill which was proposed by Home Affairs, which the National Assembly has passed, is currently with the NCOP. It was proposing for the integration of all the agencies that operate in all the ports of entry. So the NCRS, SABS, SAPS, and all these institutions that are there, to say that instead of having fragmented institutions, let us have one institution which is going to regulate the entry of goods and services and people into South Africa. And then there was a recommendation that it should have the power to collect customs as well. But the version that we passed from the National Assembly took away the customs function from the BMA. So there's no BMA which ever existed under SARS, which was taken away and everything else. It's still in a legislative form, and we have since emphasized that customs should remain a function of the revenue collector. It's one of the issues that at least shouldn't be misunderstood to have understood differently. Now, let us separate these issues that we're dealing with here. So this is the context of this report by Judge Nugent. The context, Chair, so that we are on the same page, is that Tom Moyane is appointed as a commissioner. He gets into SARS.
Chair, I wanted to ask Floyd whether should he declare about any funding from cigarette traders.
You must have a patient with me, Chair, and then we'll give a clearer context. And I think you're going to benefit a lot in terms of the context I'm going to give you now. Yes. Now the commission is appointed. The commissioner is appointed. The commissioner Tom Moyane is appointed. As per the Tax Administration Act, which says that the president should appoint the SARS commissioner. And then there's a newspaper report that points to the existence of a potentially unlawful intelligence unit within SARS. And then he calls the people who were EXCO at that time. He seeks explanation, is not satisfied, he calls a bigger meeting, he humiliates them, he fires all of them, and says that EXCO is reconstituted because a commissioner, in terms of the current legislation, can do as they wish. That is what legislation does currently. And then what followed was chaos, like admittedly chaos in SARS, because there was no institutional memory, there was a lot of bully tactics and arrogance that was displayed, because in the manner in which the Tax Administration Act is modeled now, a commissioner is super powerful, who accounts the president because he's appointed by the president. In the same way, the DGs account the president and appointed by the president. There's no clearly defined relationship between a commissioner and Minister of Finance. Of course, the Minister of Finance has to oversee the institution, but it's not clearly legislated. So the commissioner can say that I rightfully account to the president because I am appointed by the president. I want us to distinguish between two, three things. The conduct of Tom Moyane, there is no doubt, was despicable. He undermined the integrity of the institution. But that doesn't mean we must dismiss the fact that there was an illegal intelligence unit that was established in SARS. So Section 209 of the Constitution says that for an intelligence unit to be established, there must be national legislation and there must be an approval by the president. SARS conducted internal report on that. It conducted an internal report on the conduct of Johan Lochenberg and by advocate Moses Kakan. And part of the findings there said that the unit which existed, overseen by then Deputy Commissioner Ivan Pillay and Johan Lochenberg, were unlawful. That is what this report says, a legal report which was commissioned by SARS. It's a fact. And following that, the Inspector General on Intelligence conducted a thorough investigation which interviewed SARS employees, senior executives, and came to the same conclusion that there was an establishment of an illegal unit in SARS, which was hounding people, was used sometimes for political purposes in terms of how it handled issues of revenue collection. That doesn't exonerate the wrongfulness of Tom Moyane and the reckless manner in which he reacted to the unit itself. But the unit existed. It's not Sunday Times creation. Even if Sunday Times can withdraw the stories which they wrote about the unit. It did exist. This report is found currently on SARS website. If you go to SARS website and you Google Skakane SARS report, you will scribble it there, and it says that the unit which was overseen by Ivan Pillay and Johan Lohenberg was unlawful. That's what it says. The same report of the Inspector General of Intelligence concludes the same thing. This criminal prosecution, which is going to commence, I think, tomorrow, against the two individuals in SARS relating to the same case. So we must not confuse the whole issue to say that, no, the unit was right, and we don't even try to justify the covert nature that they defined, the illegal covert nature that defined the unit. I know, as a matter of fact, that the public protector is looking into that matter as well, because we took these reports to her and said that you must reach a determination in terms of the lawfulness of the unit, because it bought intelligence equipment. That is what the reports say, that they had intelligence equipment of following people and surveillance, which was not properly approved as per the legal prescripts that are necessary. That is one issue that we must treat separately. And because of the reckless nature and in the way Tom Moyane reacted, it is correct that his services at SARS was discontinued. That is a correct decision, but that doesn't exonerate those that he was trying to act against in a reckless way. They're all wrong. And that must not be confused. Now, in terms of what should happen, there are governance issues that we should deal with. And I don't think we should take the recommendations of the judge's proposals. Let's instead amend the legislation and have a board of SARS, which is going to consistently oversee the commissioners and accounting officer and the EXCO. So we can even make a provision like we did yesterday with the PIC board, like that at least three members of the executive should be directly appointed by the board and should sit as part of the board, and there's no accounting officer that can willy-nilly dismiss them or disband them in the manner that it is to be. I do not think that a proposal of an inspector general is sensible. Let us utilize the governance framework that governs a lot of state entities currently. Let us have a board. So this is what happens. The commissioner becomes the accounting officer. The board oversees the commissioner on a constant basis. The Minister of Finance becomes the political principal. Parliament becomes the oversight overall authority of all of them, of the minister, of the board, and of the CEO, like we do with other entities that belong to the National Treasury. And would then be able to then do this. It will, of course, limit some of these issues that happens of a commissioner, an accounting officer, increasing their own salaries. Because the board will have a remuneration committee which will have some terms of reference in terms of on what basis do we increase people's salaries and when do we intervene when there are problems in the organization. Those are some of the basic governance systems which we can deal with in the immediate. And the other issue which could be of consideration, which require constitutional change, could be to completely make SARS a relatively autonomous institution like the Public Protector Office, which is altogether taken off political control. Interviews of the board and commissioner by parliament, security of tenure of whoever is commissioner for 7 or 9 years, the collect taxes, they have got a non-renewable term, and the account to parliament. But that will require constitutional change. But I'm proposing that the legislative changes that we should make should be a board with an accounting officer that is constantly overseen, and Parliament plays a role in the manner in which we play with the other entities of National Treasury. And I don't understand the logic of saying the interviews of a SARS commissioner must be private. It's actually very problematic. The NDPP, the National Director of Public Prosecutions, who is going to prosecute criminals and can even prosecute a president and ministers, was publicly interviewed. Because also this notion of the candidates for SARS commissioner are not going to disclose people's tax issues. It's extremely problematic notion in terms of how the whole issue should is being handled in terms of all of these issues, because also there's some discomforting things of a commission that is acting like some executive authority that are already implementing this and that and that and that, because the commission should investigate, table a report to the executive, to the president, and then the president says that I've received the report. These are the recommendations that I'm going to take, and this is what I'm going to do with them. Not some ad hoc reports when before even submissions are done, you're already saying, do this in the meantime, we're still finalizing the other component. I don't think it's a correct way. It's problematic. I think it's also based on wrong legal philosophy. It's like what the judge said now. He says that I respect the AG's office, but you can't say that the AG's office can't be challenged. Who said that the AG can't be challenged? Who can't be challenged in South Africa? Maybe the Constitutional Court, once it has finalized, you can say we have accepted. But any other entity of the state, if you are not content with whatever decision that is the legal principles that guide South Africa today, and a judge wants to be on record in Parliament saying that I don't think there's a judge that will ever question the AG. What if the AG is conflicted, was embedded in some corrupt activities? So we must expunge that component which was said here on behalf of the judiciary. It's an unfortunate statement that was made. But I think that the governance issues that were proposed, in the manner in which they were proposed, we must reject them. We'll then deal with the issues of how the ombuds deal with some of the taxpayer issues appropriately. But the immediate interventions which we can make is to put a proper governance structure in SARS, not the Inspector General that is being proposed. It's problematic. Thank you very much.
Chair, thank you very much. We appreciate the report as it has been presented by Commissioner Nugent, Judge Nugent. Let me make a disclaimer that I was not there when this whole saga happened, but I came in when Judge Nugent's commission has already been appointed. I strongly believe that, Chairperson, we still need to discuss this report, especially as the caucus of the ANC, and engage with it so that ultimately we may, you know, take decisions or even consult. I am tempted to agree with Comrade Shibambu that I don't believe that there is anyone in this country who might be declared as having no constituency. If we are saying now that we should appoint someone with no constituency to preside, to oversee SARS, who is that person? Where are you going to get that person? So it becomes a little bit problematic. I think we need to support the proposal that says a board should be established. Then we'll look at the nitty-gritties of establishing the board. As a politician, I'm also tempted to think about whether or not there was a global agenda, you know, that might have been there, which occurred this whole thing. I'm thinking of this company, Bain and Company, a US-based company. You know, Chair, if you want to infiltrate, if you want to render a country inefficient, you need to infiltrate National Treasury and SARS. You know, this company comes in here. Mr. Tom Moyane could have been appointed innocently by the president. not knowing that maybe there was a global agenda, why would you dismantle a governance system, you know, and render SARS ungovernable? So we need to think about imperialistic agendas. After that, Comrade Chair, we were declared as the credit agencies of the world declared as inefficient and so forth and so forth. On our part as politicians, I think we need to be even more vigilant, you know, about what is obtaining in these institutions of government. That is just a comment. A question, is this Bain and Company still there? Are they still operating at SAS? Maybe it's just a question. Thank you.
I'm just going to raise a few questions. Firstly, just to inform you, we meet with SARS and National Treasury quarterly, okay, Judge and your colleagues. And as Tandy said in our original statement, we've asked a lot of the questions. And the answers you get are credible. Whether they're true, I don't know, and I think the members could not tell. But they're credible. For example, we asked, why did you close the large business center? There was a credible answer given. Okay? We asked on a whole lot of things. So, you know, with due respect, firstly, let me put this to you, Judge. My own view. First, let me just make something very clear to everybody who's here, not least the members. Ours is just an initial foray into this report, an initial exchange with you. Secondly, it's not as if we here will be effecting amendments to the bill, to the law. As I told you, the reason we have you here is because we will write a report on the fiscal framework for Parliament. That will be our last major work. And in it, as we've done before, we make recommendations on France. With due respect to Peggy, we have taken decisions, but we do not anymore have to say those are our existing decisions. Based on your recommendations, we can review them, but we have taken some decisions already on what we think should happen to SARS based on our own experiences. So the first thing to stress is that in our report, the majority will decide, make some recommendations, initial ones, on what we think or responses to your reports. But let me first say to you and your team, my own view, and it remains mine, a chair doesn't have any more power than the mandates you get from a committee. I want to compliment your commission for the vigorous, rigorous, decisive manner in which you acted. I really think you did everything remarkably with, from what I can tell, limited resources, limited constraints, and unlike many commissions, you delivered on time. The question Mr. Shivambu raises that has entered my head, funny enough, listening to you today, you're unusual I'm in the parliamentary system since 94. It's unusual. I can't recall a commission that actually, makes such decisive statements and expects, in this case, SARS to act, without the government, without the president having said anything and so on. That does surprise me. And I'll be very interested in your reply. We also have another judge here. By the way, may I welcome Marking, and I forgot to acknowledge you. Obviously, you're more than welcome. So that did surprise me. There are many things that, you know what, it's neither here nor there. It's not a rehash of the commission. Mr. Shivambu predictably says what he says, that the view of himself and his party here. And this is not a commission. So for what I took from him, that's of value, for me at least, I can't speak for others, it is surprising that a commission, you speak, the way you speak, I think, is, look, I can't speak for Mr. Shivam, but let me speak for myself. The way you speak is, you are an executive authority. You're saying things like, SARS has already begun to do these things and so on. I don't know where the National Treasury has processed that. I don't know whether the presidency has processed that. So that's an interesting thing I'd like your answer to. But I want to assure you, look, we are human as members of parliament. We make mistakes. But I have asked privately, with Tandi in particular, whom I see most of, but also every now and then with others, about what can we do if you ask the questions and you get the answer. How do you prove a commissioner or a DG is lying through his teeth? I have raised in this committee in different contexts that Parliament needs to hold people who lie to us through their teeth and act against them. We have that power. We should do it. I was referring to, I think, in a context where it applied to a DG, not the commissioner, or the head of a public entity. It wasn't in respect to Tom Moyane necessarily. So the first thing I think in our exit report around our experiences of this is Parliament needs to act against people. Secondly, if you're chairing a committee, and you've been around as long as I have been, 1971, my first political activity, right? You bump into people and they raise things. And let me assure you, Judge Nugent, a lot of people said a lot of things, both supporting the commissioner, Moyane, and opposing him. There were people who would WhatsApp you sometimes while you're in a committee meeting and saying he's lying. No committee chair, no MP can use that as a criteria. I have bumped into people at airports and so on and said, can you, in some form, give us the evidence? There are ministers, there's nothing to hide, and members of parliament also who come to you from both sides and saying, you're giving the commissioner too hard a time, you're too soft. We say, bring us the evidence. But many people are vulnerable. So I don't know, Judge Nugent, what you can do within the constraints of the norms and rules of parliament. How can you say to a DG or a senior official, you're lying? And then where's the evidence that he or she is lying? So parliament needs to act. Where we can prove somebody lied, we should use our full powers. Our lawyer, who's attached to this committee, is serving another committee. It's something you need to maybe come in on. We've raised this before, Judge Nugent. Then I want to say that, I did not hear what Mr. Lackey said to your commission, but several people contacted. People who don't even know what happened and said, it's very atypical of you, knowing you as a chair, that you would do nothing. And I wanted to come to this committee and ask them for a mandate to appear before your commission. But obviously that would not have been possible because the DA deferred quite fundamentally with the approach of the ANC on what to do with Mr. Lackey. So they won't agree. I'm not sure what Mr. Shivambu's position was. And the problem I had about appearing before your commission, I'm not very technologically savvy. Somebody said he was going, you can find what he said. But I did not respond to him. I could not appear before your commission, but my own personal integrity is an issue because it's ultimately the chair that accounts for a committee. The whip accounts for the party political structure. So 20 years from now, somebody writes a book on this and says they wrote to Karim in September and they did nothing. So it is finally, after consultation, I wrote that letter too, which is actually a media reply. I got frustrated when Mr. Lackey is now going into the public domain. The case hasn't been dropped against him. He suddenly goes on and says, I wrote to these two committee chairs, they did nothing. Then I asked Peter Dutoy, it's not fair. So he said, yeah, you can have 1,200 words. So once I wrote in the media, all I did was I took that. Moreover, I referred you to a committee decision. So on Mr. Lackey, Mr. Nugent, Judge Nugent, I doubt you could have done very much more. The issues were very conflated. He gives you a skewed, and he's not here, therefore I'll be limited in what I say. It's not fair. We're not having a commission here. And he's not here to reply. But it is not true that the committee did nothing. The letter is in your report, presumably as an annexure. I don't know if it appears there. But he wrote to me while I was in a study group meeting, Tandi, he wrote to me at 17:25. I replied to him at 18:45. He replied to me at 18:53. I spoke to Connie September at 21:05, and we came to a division of labor. So just to make it clear, we can do nothing. Even if we knew now, if we knew then what we know now, what could the committee have done? We proposed to Mr. Lackey the following: one, his labor relations issues. We can't intervene, Judge Nugent. I would like you to know, how do you expect us, as a committee, with an autonomous organ, even a department, we can raise questions. But if a senior official of a department is fired, there are the CCMA processes, there's the labor court. We have no authority to intervene in that issue. No authority. You must show us some data. Maybe I can have a chat with you over tea, because then we can make proposals. What do you do? Secondly, on the issue of the high-risk investigation unit, some so-called rogue intelligence unit, that matter was referred to Connie September, which is why in the first place Mr. Lekay wrote. We engaged with Parliament's Legal Services Unit, who said, you really have no role here. We then went to the Speaker's office, who said those matters must be handled by the Intelligence Committee. As far as I know, the Committee, in fact, of Intelligence did deal with the matter. Then Mr. Mania and Mr. Alice, who joined the committee, requested a copy of the minutes of that meeting, I think, or the report of the Intelligence Committee, remember? I then spoke to Ms. September and said, why don't you just give the report? And she said she cannot take a request from anybody who is not a member of that committee, that the DA member should request it, and she will not release it, and so on. So I don't know what more we could have done. But there's a point that many of us make, which is, there is a need for some sort of oversight authority, Judge Nugent. You have suggested an Inspector General, right? Now, what Mr. Lekay really wanted, this Parliament shouldn't be able to do. It shouldn't. It's just wrong. What he wanted, in effect, was an open inquiry by this committee into whether the intelligence unit exists. And that's the effect of what he was asking. Now, can you imagine? You notice the initial needling of each other. Each politician here from each different party would take a very different view of whether the HRIU was legitimate or not. We're not technical experts. It'll become highly politicized. And in fact, at that time, it was a highly politicized environment, even within the ANC, with two major groupings, those supporting that unit, those opposing it. So you can't do a commission of inquiry, is what he wanted. And it's your commission, finally, rightly so, that in a peripheral way deals with this matter. And if it's necessary, there should be a commission that investigates that in an open way. Mr. Shivambu still holds the view that that unit is illegal. So there should be maybe a commission that looks into it. But you can't have a committee, neither the Standing Committee on Intelligence or the Finance Committee. Those must be dealt with on the commissions, which are not politicized. They must deal with it there. You can't expect, I don't expect the rules to change now to if such a thing ever happened again. On the issue of the intelligence unit, let me remind members, the majority agree that SARS must have an intelligence unit. It is absurd, given the high levels of illicit trade taking place, illicit financial flows and so on. Mr. Mione himself, in G26, when I put it to him, do revenue-raising authorities have such an intelligence arm? He said yes. I think even should they have them, I think he said yes. His point was, this was done illegally. So as far as I know, the majority in this committee believe it should have an intelligence capacity, it should work with other intelligence agencies in the state, and it should be done through the law. So I don't think the majority will change its view on that. It would be absurd to say SARS mustn't have something. On the matter of Stein, of similar issues arose, I won't bore you. I don't know whether you looked at the Skakane report, but I took it that you did. So maybe you want to respond to Mr. Shivambu on that. On the issue of, I think Mr. Lees makes the point that will the Inspector General account to Parliament or to the public on, let's say, decisions about whether people are paying tax. Now, again, the majority in this committee, I think the EFF supports this, if I'm correct, but I can't remember. You see, on the matter of the accusations against the Guptas, and constant accusations that other senior people in business and in politics are not paying our taxes in the case of politicians, we asked whether it is possible to have a closed meeting where the persons accused of not paying their taxes appear, so do their lawyers, and we are sworn in like the Standing Committee on Intelligence is, right? And we allow the person to be given a chance. Is it that you're not paying your tax? Let us say it's the President Ramaphosa is not paying his tax. Then he must appear before that closed committee. But the problem we had, Judge Judith, we asked our lawyers to look into it for the next term of Parliament, because we also, before your commission, thought that should be reviewed. The point about privacy that Tandy makes, surely there are limits to that. Surely if the President of our country now is not paying his taxes, yes, we hold to account, because the commissioner is a buddy of his, and so on. Who is going to hold the commissioner to account for not holding President Ramaphosa to account for these taxes? That's the point we made. So we said, can we have a closed meeting? But you see, Judge Newton, if I am standing against Peggy Nkonyeni for the provincial chairpersonship of the ANC in our province, KZN, I will smear things about Peggy, and Peggy will smear things about me. Then the Parliamentary Committee on Finance is going to haul us there. If we get acquitted by that committee, and we have paid our taxes, do you think we're going to recover from the first page stories on the City Press and Sunday Times and Sowetan, somewhere on page 3, that Karim is innocent, Nkonyeni is innocent? So that's the problem we had. So I personally felt that it should be the ombudsperson. The ombudsperson should have that power, and with somebody as illustrious as the current judge, may he live forever, you know, I have the greatest confidence that those matters will get sorted out, right? So what I'm saying is, Judge, there's another problem that you must address. We pass laws. The law says that a person who works for SARS, as we know it, cannot leak stuff, right? On the Lakey matter, while we were processing it, even through the ANC structures, I want to discuss why we are unapologetic about that, Judge. You are in a party political system. There are some things that are managed through the parliamentary process. There's nothing to hide, complemented by the ANC processes, right? So, in short, we did not know, on my word of honor, and I don't think any member, that the reason Lakey was taken to court, Mr. Lakey, was not because he violated the privacy provisions of the law, which we passed. How can we then say don't apply the law that we passed to Mr. Tom Moyane? He was taken on a false counts of defamation, after which the committee took a decision. Right? And I also want to remind the committee of the decision we took, and I'm about to conclude. But there's a lot of misunderstanding here about the role of the committee. We wrote to you, Judge Newton, at the very last minute after I consulted with one lawyer, and he said, no, you must write. I want to remind what this committee, what it decided. We were told by Mr. Kingon that the reason he was taken to court was because of defamation, and you can't do that. Our decision was that if Mr. Lakey was taken to court, then on wrong grounds, then the money, I'll read to you the relevant sections. The committee, we passed the report on the 20th of October. Remember, this is what we decided. It's now a report. The committee notes, I'm just going to read a small part of it so that the committee remembers, Peggy, what decision we took. The committee notes the withdrawal of the SARS case against Mr. Adrian Lakey. It was understood that Mr. Lakey was primarily being taken to court because of breaches of secrecy in terms of Chapter 6 of the Tax Administration Act, Section 67, 68, 69, and 236, and also for defamation, but we thought the main reason was that. The committee could obviously not interfere in these allegations of Mr. Lakey's transgressions. Whether Mr. Lakey was taken to court because he had written to the chairpersons of SCOF and the JSCI, or because he was suspected of leaking his correspondence to others and into the public domain was not clear. If it was solely because he wrote to the chairperson's judge, we'll agree with you. It reinforces the need for a structure. This is what we voted on. Maybe a board, we said, an inspector general's office, the office of the ombud, or some other structure where such matters as those raised in Mr. Lakey's correspondence can be addressed fairly in closed meetings, apart from, in his specific case, the office of the inspector general of intelligence. Now, Connie told him to go to the Inspector General of Intelligence. I do not know whether he did that. There is a structure. For you to say, Judge, with the greatest of respect, there's no way he could go. He could go to the CCMA, as indeed he did. And he could go to the Labour Court, but obviously he's disadvantaged, right? Cost of lawyers. He could go to the Inspector General of Intelligence. But if you're saying they are not adequate structures, you're right. And if you're saying, as you are, the committees mustn't deal with this in this highly politicized environment, can you imagine that Mr. Lee Standi and Mr. Shibambu, and I agree on the HRI, will be fighting you all the time. You'll have to have another commission to investigate us for fighting. So you did the right thing. I like what Mr. Shibambu says. Initially, we supported a board, remember. But after Mr. Kingon came and made such an impressive input on an inspector general, we actually suggested an inspector general in another report, right? So when I heard Mr. Shibambu again, Mr. Kingon, I'm beginning to teeter towards saying, I don't have a view, but there should be some structure. Parliament, I'm pleading with the members who come back to deal with Mr. Lakay's issues. Finally, this is a decision we took. I'm reminding members, if the case against Mr. Lakay was based solely on allegations of defamation, and SAR's current legal interpretation is correct that organs of state cannot sue for defamation, the committee believes that serious considerations need to be given by SARS for the costs of the litigation to be retrieved, Mr. Kingon, from those responsible. The committee requires SARS to respond to this at the next quarterly briefing to the committee. That's what we've said. They must pay the money if they did the wrong thing. There are many other things I could say, but I can see Nati's getting impatient with me. No one asked him. Fine, we should be finished. Okay, Nati, go for it. I've got other things, but I'll drop them for now.
No, thanks very much, Honorable Chair. I was not trying to intimidate you, by the way.
No, you know what you're doing.
I'm trying very hard to behave under the circumstances, really. I do think that we need to create a structure for processing this report. Now, right now, the interventions are completely unstructured, if I may put it that way. And that's why, you know, a person like myself, I'm really trying very hard to hold back. Precisely because I think there is a need to create a structure to therefore delve properly into the report. Now, the pivotal point here arising out of this report are issues of institutional collapse, issues of governance, and relating the institutional arrangements and so on. So I do think that perhaps the honourable member Ngonyele made a valuable point to then say perhaps let's go back to study the report properly, but come back into a dedicated discussion around some of the matters that are raised therein, and decide how far we want to process them and so on. And I appreciate the fact that a person like myself was never here really when you dealt with the whole range of other issues and so on, and therefore you also get caught up into the background kind of issues and stuff like that. But I think we need to be able to go over that and then start saying to ourselves, how do we therefore begin to sort out the institutional arrangement issues as well as governance issues pertaining to SARS and so on. And I think we can therefore also in such a discussion deal with the conceptual issues. I think some of the issues that were raised by Honourable Member Shibambu about some of the things that the judge said and so on, we can also still come back to that. But I think we shouldn't lose sight of what the real issue is that we need to focus on and sort out. Thank you very much.
We will not be able to meet again on the Nugent Commission. All we're doing is to get a feel for this and see if there's anything we're going to put in our report for next week. The sort of thing you're saying is what we could recommend in our report, that the Sixth Parliament, Finance Committee, Appropriations Committee, maybe even intelligence committee, I don't know, the speaker can decide. So remember, all we're doing today is giving you initial individual responses. There's nobody who has a mandate here, right? We haven't discussed it in our respective study groups. Mr. Shivambu on the other hand, because he's the only member, well, he may speak for his party, but for the ANC certainly, we in no position to, this is just, it's an, what we're calling here is like it's a brainstorming session. That's what it is, no more. And I doubt very much that we will have time to meet this term. So it's the next term that the committee will, and it's right, they must process things from, the review of the report. Yeah.
We have something.
Yeah, very quickly, okay. Chandi and Mr. Shivambu.
I wanted to add whether on issues that the commission looked at, they also look at the Hogan Lovell report. Yeah.
Chair. I think we can maybe in a different meeting when we're discussing other issues have reflections on this report and have specific recommendations on what the sixth parliament should do, particularly on legislative issues. Because if we don't make the laws, this commission is going to make laws like they're doing now. They're going to try to be lawmakers and give instructions. You come back to the sixth parliament, you find an inspector general of SARS who do not know how it was established. Anything is possible by the way, by the direction they're taking. Anything is possible. So we need to give a legislative framework. Of course, because the legislative process itself takes time. Let us agree on, I'm sure the ANC will meet in a study group and then you'll develop a perspective on what should specifically happen so that our power is not reserved by unelected people.
I'm about to just provide some direction. Firstly, I think, with due respect to the members, I think the point has been made that this commission seems to be unlike other commissions, right? But now to say the things you're saying, Mr. Shivambu, this is a judge, and we must also respect the position he occupies. And I think the comments you made, I can't stop you from making them. Well, I don't agree with them. No unelected person, whether it's a judge or anybody, is going to make any Auditor General come into effect without this Parliament having a bill to process it. And I don't think Judge Nugent has any such illusion. So I would like to dissociate myself from that statement, but it is right to say what he said. Secondly, I urge Shivambu and Minister Shivambu and Nati to think this through. If you go by the past, 60-70% of the members of this committee will be new. To give you one example, when we took over this committee or became members of this committee in July 2014, there was only one ANC member there from the previous era. Okay? That's the party you and I belong to. And we can maybe strike a compromise on what you and Mr. Shivambu are saying, that we have some sort of discussion and some broad thing, but we cannot prescribe to the sixth committee, which will go through this, not like us, as you say, in unstructured, never meant to be structured. It's a brainstorming thing. They will go through it thoroughly. We can't prescribe to them, but look, can we keep this on the agenda? Let's look at what you and Mr. Shivambu are saying, and let's discuss it in our respective party study groups. So if the majority feel we should meet again before we rise on the 20th, then who am I? I'm just a glorified administrator here. I have to do it, whether I agree or disagree. Yes, Tandi, please, now, can we move on?
Okay, you know how we process issues in the ANC. We will come to that determination in the ANC study group whether we want to.
Over to you, Judge.
Yes, may I respond to some of the things? Very interesting things that are raised in it. Well, I've got there are a lot of things raised. If I forget a few, will someone just remind me? Let me just start with a lot was said about this committee and Mr. Lacker, etc. I use Mr. Lacker as an example, but I didn't find anything in my report that was critical of this committee. Perhaps Mr. Chairman found something. There's nothing in this report critical of the way the committee handled it. Let me read what the report says about this committee. And incidentally, the letter that was written to me explaining what happened to this commission is in my part of the report. Oh, sorry, it's part of the report. The whole letter is there. Let me read what was said. On 22 November 2018, Mr. Yunus Karim, chairperson of the Standing Committee on Finance, wrote to the Commission in response to evidence of Mr. Lacay that the Standing Committee had done nothing in consequence of his letter. Mr. Karim's letter is appendix answer. We have noted his contention that parliamentary committees have no scope for intervening in matters of that kind. If that is so, it reinforces our recommendation that the post of Inspector General, who could intervene, must be created. It is not acceptable if intervention in what occurred is not possible even by parliamentarians. That is the long and the short of what was said. So if there is a suggestion that, as there has been, that somehow we were critical of this, and it goes back to the very first point, it's not there. But what the point we made was, Mr. Lacay came here, for better or for worse, I don't say, you know, everything he said was true or not, he came here for better or for worse and got nowhere. And that is why I use that as an example to explain why I think an Inspector General is an important, very important, because he could have gone there. Now leave Mr. Lacay apart. What about the many others in SARS who had difficulties? Where could they go? That's the point. So please, let's leave out this committee and how he dealt with it. We didn't say a word about it. We published what you said, and that's it. The question is raised about whether it should not be an Inspector General but a board. Well, that view was put forward by some people. We didn't accept that view. We didn't think that it was going to be able to assist. And it goes back to, as well, something that Mr. Chairman raised about how does a committee know if someone comes with a DG or whatever comes before it, how do we know if he's telling the truth? Of course you can't know. And very much like a board, because you can't conduct your affairs in that way in order to find out, as you've rightly said. And nor is a board able to do that. And that is why we say there should be an Inspector General. And we say it should be an Inspector General who has the powers similar to those of the Commission of Inquiry, that he can interrogate people. Which a board can't do. And that's the big distinction. Mr. Schoenwalder says, no, I don't know about parliamentary
charity. We can come back.
You can debate that.
Yeah, we can debate that.
You are.
For what it's worth, I won't be here, but I'm teaching now back towards the Inspector General.
But anyway, look, let me just make it clear. These are our recommendations.
Sorry, Judge, that's how we behave in this committee. Please, I'm sorry about our conduct.
No, behave as you wish. Just tell me when I'm allowed to talk, that's all.
Yeah, no, carry on. Okay, carry on.
Just tell me.
By the way, she's apologizing, Judge, for herself, not for the committee. She has no authority to apologize.
This is not my terrain. You must just tell me what the rules are. No, I realize that. So that essentially is identified why we rejected a board. Now, these are recommendations that are made by. We're not telling you what you should. We're saying this is what we recommend. Parliament will decide what to do. That's their business. We finished our business. That's our recommendation. Now, let me go back to the beginning. It was said our ability to get to the nitty-gritty of things is different. Well, of course it is in a committee. The same point I'm making. Of course it is. An Inspector General can get to the nitty-gritty. That's what he can do. And that's why I talk about a lean organization. I want to put Advocate Steinberg on it alone and ask some questions, and then she can report it to you. But that's what we're trying to overcome, is the difficulty that there was. And there was difficulty, you're quite right to say, at the time break up a large business center. Well, it's credible. Of course it is. But if someone spent some days there talking to the large business center and asking them about it and thinking about the implications, which this committee can't, is not able to do, frankly, then you can question the breaking up of the large business center and the abandonment of the cigarette inquiries and the abandonment of the integrity unit and the abandonment of the compliance unit and so forth and so on. All of it will get back to why my central point to you earlier was the importance of the Inspector General, what it can be done and what can't be done. As far as taxpayer affairs are concerned, again, you know, the Commission of Inquiry is entitled to get access to taxpayer affairs. Well, I looked at the affairs of a number of taxpayers. I did myself, together with the assistance of Mr. King and at times, and a few times with Edwin Steinberg. None of the others looked at those affairs. An Inspector General can look at those affairs. Now, there's a big debate, of course, not only here but around the world, as to whether public figures should disclose their tax affairs. Well, that's not a debate we've gone into. It's a very interesting debate, but I leave it to people who make policy to decide. That wasn't a matter that we looked at. There was a question of, is the limit of malfeasance, as we've stated it in our report, I think the answer to that, again, in the report is, it says, we say in the report, absence of proof is not proof of absence. In other words, we said, we can't say that things did not occur. I think that there are matters that should be inquired into a lot further. And we said that in the report. We said, look, as we look at one thing, it uncovers another thing. And so we went on. And we said the President may wish to reconstitute a commission with different terms of reference to look at a number of other things. And I think the questions you raise are legitimate things that are worthy of inquiry, but we certainly don't say that this was the limit of malfeasance that occurred by any means. And I hope we've made that very plain. You know, inquiries of that kind, you know, these things are done in secret, malfeasance of that kind. It's not very, you don't just call someone and say, well, did you take a bribe? It's a lot more complex than that and takes a long time. So that wasn't really as far as we can go. You asked about the person in charge of information technology. I think it's a matter that Mr. Kingan may well answer. We don't set out to run SARS. We set out to make certain inquiries into certain matters. The management of SARS is far beyond my capacity. Maybe Mr. Kushler, who is busy, maybe he knows about these things, but I'm just a judge what I know about running a business. But certainly our impression was and a very definite impression was that the information technology there is far too complex for the person who is in charge of it. And if you look at the background of the person in charge, I don't think that it reflects experience of such complex technology. But that is a matter ultimately for the Commissioner. So what is meant with in consultation, I think, was also asked by you. In consultation means you talk to him, but you're not obliged to follow their advice. So it is not a break on the President. We think that the President is the person who should have the ultimate decision. But we do think that in making his decision, he should take account of how the Treasury sees a particular person, what relationship they have had with the person, if so, and take advice from him. That would be nice. Right?
It's a quick correction on that. We used after consultation, and of course, legally, after consultation relates to what the judges actually said. You take consideration, you bear in mind the issues that have been raised, but you're still at liberty to go on a different path as opposed to in consultation. So the report makes a recommendation in relation to the appointment by the President after consultation.
Thank you very much. There was also a suggestion here that I'd said that the Auditor General can't be challenged. I'm not sure where that came from. I said the opinions, the accounting opinions of an auditor and the auditor general in opinion. You can't challenge those. Of course you can challenge his decisions if he's corrupt. You can challenge his decisions if he's just acted blindly without advice and so forth, if they're made in bad faith, if they're reckless. Of course they can be challenged. But all auditors express opinions, no more than opinions. There's no science in auditing, in accounting. And they express an opinion, and that is their opinion, that a court can't interfere with and say, well, I have a different opinion on the accounts. It's to that extent that I say that a court would not interfere. And may I just add, I don't speak for the judiciary, as I said here. I just speak for Judge Nugent, and I do have some knowledge of the law, though.
If we may add on that, part of our reflection, just on the point that the judge has dealt with, bore in mind the provisions of the Constitution in relation to cooperative governance, particularly sections 41C and H, Roman figure 6, relating to the need for these organs of state to act in a cooperative way. And of course, part of the point that's raised in relation to that in H is cooperate with one another in a mutual trust and good faith by fostering friendly relations, assisting and supporting one another, and if it goes, the number of others, and I'll just go to Roman figure 6, avoiding legal proceedings against one another. And so it is in that context that we considered it unusual within the scheme of cooperative governance provided by the Constitution that these organs of state would deal with each other in the way they did.
You know, there are so many legal cases where different spheres of the state and organs have challenged each other. There's a lot of jurisprudence in the constitutional court in terms of that. So if it's about law, like there's really problematic interpretation of it.
I think
an opportunistic as well.
We're running out of time. Let the judge reply, and then we'll see how much of time we've got. Yeah.
Well, if my law is bad, well, it's bad. So there it is. I wanted to just go back to mention something about this this unit. Now, this unit that was said to be rogue. Now, it was not a matter that fell within the scope. Our scope started on the 1st of April. These things took place. They started 10 years before that. It wasn't a matter for him. But what was relevant for us is, may you have such a unit. And for that reason, we asked ourselves a question arising from that, where people had said it was an unlawful unit. Was it unlawful? And I kept asking the question of people, because I had thought it's not unlawful, but some may have thought so, and they should tell me, what is it that I've missed? Because, as you know, I miss a lot of the law. And certainly I read Advocate Sikakani's report, and I read it with great care, and that's the problem. I couldn't find in his report why he said it was unlawful. He said it was. I couldn't see on what basis. So indeed I wrote to Advocate Sikakani. I said, Advocate Sikakani, I've read your report. I can't find in here why it's unlawful. Can you expand upon that? I got a letter back saying, that's what I said, and I've got nothing more to say. So that didn't help me. And then I wrote to Judge Kroon, who had also said it was unlawful. Judge Kroon, I said, can you tell me why it's unlawful? He came back and said, well, Sikakani said it was unlawful. So I got no further. And I kept asking the question as to why it was unlawful. Because, as you see in a report, we have recommended that such a unit be reestablished. To make that recommendation, I needed to be satisfied that I'm not saying go and do something unlawful. So that was the context. But as to whether this unit existed or not, what it did, what people got up to, well, that really wasn't a matter that was under inquiry. There were people that tried to force us down that road. Well, we didn't accept that invitation. We thought that there were more important things to deal with.
Chairperson, we have to provide guidance here.
You can't provide guidance. A chair that does.
Because
No.
But Section 209 says that an establishment of an intelligence unit must happen through legislation. How can you recommend that you must establish an intelligence unit without proper legislation? What kind of a judge are you?
No, fine. This has to stop, really. This is a stop. Can you... No.
Mr. Chairman,
I'm not recognizing the authority of that question.
I've gone through insults for 6 months.
Yeah.
I told them at the beginning, insult me as much as you wish. I will get on with my job. So
no,
don't worry, I'm not,
we do not accept that. The majority in this committee, I take it, do not accept that. Right. Can you, Vuyo, reply and continue? Mr. Shivambu's issue is irrelevant to this committee. Thank you.
One other matter I really wanted to add to, Chair, relates to the issue of the board as opposed to the Inspector General. And again, as indicated by the judge, those were both conceded, and we elected to suggest what the judge recommended. In a classical sense, the board is essentially responsible for directing and controlling an institution. Now, you have, in relation to a revenue authority, power granted by law to the commissioner and other functionaries, maybe ancillary to that. You don't want to constrain the exercise of that power or overlay into it through a structure that might not be an efficient mechanism. So when we looked at that, we really looked at what you are really seeking is to ensure that when there are instances of things being alleged to have been done improperly, there could be an intervention. Now, our revenue authority is perhaps not in a lonesome space around revenue authorities in the world who've gotten through some form of scandal. We know the United States, the IRS, had the same issues relating to a revenue authority that was alleged to be involving political profiling and looking out at which NGOs, which political opponents to target. And the effective way of establishing whether that was done, for example, in the U.S., was to invoke the powers of an inspector general. And as indicated in the report, what you're looking for here is someone who can get into any issue with the fullest of detail and be able to account whether there has been improper conduct or not. And so we looked at it in that way. For example, the point that's been raised, if there's a suggestion that the commissioner or any other officer of SARS has conducted themselves in a way inconsistent with the law, in relation to the tax affairs of a political office bearer or somebody else, there must be somebody to whom that issue could be directed to who would have the fullest access to information, which we don't believe it might necessarily be a prudent thing to do in relation to a board. And that was the consideration we gave to. Clearly, as the judge said, these are mere recommendations. There may be greater wisdom as to different options that could be pursued.
Question for the clarity of members, right? You don't want to create too many structures, but is it ruled out in your view, or maybe you don't have a view, that you have an inspector general with that focus? Are people paying their taxes? Is the commissioner and other senior managers, whoever in SARS, not colluding with anybody who should be paying taxes and preventing them from paying taxes? Those sort of issues, right? And then you have a board that does the oversight, both structures. Now, do you know any, you're not international experts, but do you think it rules out having both with specific functions that are different but complementary in a way? It's another option to think of. Yes, Tandy?
Chair, we're running a risk of discussing the recommendations when we have not applied our minds on all the details in the... Please hear me. We're running that risk. There's a set of recommendations that we need to consider. And we're going to apply our minds on them. And when I say we, I'm speaking like I'm already in the sixth parliament, because basically in terms of time frames, there's limitations to engage further And the ANC has not even engaged. And I know the temptation comes from the type of insinuations you are making from our side in terms of engaging the report to the extent and the effect where the commission finds itself having to respond to justify how it arrived at the recommendations. I don't think we're in that mode as a collective in the current conjuncture. We'll come to a point, a parliament will come to a point where it will make that determination. Like the chair said, it's a preliminary engagement to understand the nuances of arriving at this conclusion. I want us to suggest, Chair, because I can't counter-engage on all the issues that has been raised, either by the commission or the members, because I'm rushing to the next meeting, which is the WIPARI meeting, which is taking place in the next 10 minutes. So I want to suggest that let's take the report as is and we'll deal with it and internalize and even decide on the process matter on how to process it, including if we need to make recommendations to the House before we rise. I don't know whether it's that acceptable, Chair, and leave all other things that will lead to theatrics that are always obtaining in the committee as and when we're discussing matters of this nature. Thanks.
One quick question. Is it consistent with your report to say that the commissioner should be appointed? Why should the commissioner not be appointed through a transparent, open process? Is there a specific rationale for that? Just to get clarity on what's in the report. I'm not taking any positions, I'm just asking.
No. There is no reason why it shouldn't.
Yeah.
The question is to which is the best way to choose the person concerned. There is a danger when you have television cameras on, etc., that people don't speak openly. And when you're talking about the essential characteristics of this person, as it is with the NDP, of integrity, you want to be able to talk openly. And I think that might be inhibited if it was done in public. And that is our concern.
Close for now to remind ourselves, that it's the sixth parliament, not ours. Before I conclude, Judge Ngwepe, do you want to say anything?
I do, very briefly, because as you know, I also have a constituent to represent. My mandate is protect taxpayers, tax on board, but in that context, can I just make one or two observations? One of which is this, on the issue of management, on the board and inspector. Well, Chairperson, the board governs, the inspector inspects. These are two different concepts. And I just leave my observation there, which also means that you could have both. You could have both of them, because these are two different concepts. The other point, observation I want to make is with regard to you pulling out your hair, such as little as is still there, to try and say, what do we do with people who come here to lie and all that sort of thing? But can I just make a general observation, because in my other capacities I come across this sort of phenomenon. Chairperson, as a general observation in this country, yes, you may want to refer to the Attorney General or the Director of Public Prosecutions to prosecute people who lied to in Parliament, the like, and so forth and so forth. Those are the remedies you want. Would like to do in reaction to the problem. That's a fundamental observation I want to make. In general, I think some part of the problem is that in this country, maybe it's because we are still going through the pain of growing ourselves as a new nation. I think we must do everything possible to populate important positions with people of integrity. To me, I would like somebody who has got to come to speak to Parliament. Obviously, such a person is a very senior person. I would like to have that kind of person to be of such integrity that he would not he or she would not lie to a primary school kid. He or she would not even lie to a high school kid. He or she won't even lie to a university student, let alone lying to members of Parliament. And I think if we got those basics right, to make sure that we populate these vital, important positions with people of absolute integrity, will diminish some of the problems, if really not eliminate them, which of course ties to the point which Judge Nugent is making with regard to the quality of mechanisms as to how we should appoint people to certain positions. A thorough good mechanism to make sure that we get the right people that we can populate in those positions. Except that in closing, I don't agree that the interviewing of the next commissioner should be in private. I think people are to be appointed judges, are interviewed publicly, they are asked about their personal affairs, their financial affairs, everything, and in fact people who are professionals, they are exposed to the light, and sometimes they don't even get appointed, and yet they have got to still go back to their practices after having been exposed to that kind of thing. I have serious reservations about what I heard has been happening about interviewing prospective commissioners in private. Serious reservations. Thank you.
So to us, I particularly like this idea that board governs the inspector. So actually, you know, as brief as you were, it's very helpful. Thank you very much. Once again, may I say, on behalf of the majority in this committee, Judge Nugent and your team, we are deeply, deeply grateful for the excellent work you've done, which is not to say, needless to say, you yourself will know, Judge, that we'll agree with everything. It's a sixth term of Parliament that will decide, but the majority of us here, we really think it's an excellent work, and we're really proud of that we have people of your caliber here. And we're also very grateful that we have somebody of the caliber of Judge Ngwepe. Never mind that he's rude about my hair. And my hair is defenseless, it can't fight back. So on its behalf, I object on its non-existence. But thank you very much, Judge Ngwepe and the Ombuds Office as well. So thank you all. We meet next week on the budget issues. Thank you indeed.
About it. On the center.
Yeah.